People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Disability, history, power. How do the stories of people with disabilities get recorded in the documents we use to decipher the past? Whose stories didn't get written down? When institutions like psychiatric hospitals control and restrict access to decades-old archives, are they protecting people's privacy? Are they protecting themselves from potential lawsuits? Questions like these are just some of what's explored in the book Cripping the Archive, a collection of 20 distinct chapters from different authors. It spans continents and centuries, taking a critical eye to how disability has, or oftentimes hasn't, been recorded. It often questions the power structures that gave today's historians what they have to work with. And as the editors write, it seeks to reveal how power produces an abyss of silence and absence about disability. I spoke with the book's editors.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Hunt Kennedy. I'm a professor of history at the University of New Brunswick and director of the Muriel McQueen Ferguson Center for Family Violence Research, also at the University of New Brunswick.
Hello, I'm Jen Barkley. I'm a historian at the University at Buffalo, and I'm also the associate director for the Center for Disability Studies here.
And you are both behind the book, the new collection, Cripping the Archive, Disability, History, and Power. And I think a good place to start is just with the name. Can you tell me what that means, Cripping the Archive, and where it came from?
Sure. So the term cripping is a kind of reclamation, a kind of taking pride in a term that's been a very kind of ableist term used in the past. So it's kind of a reclaiming of that term from people who kind of champion this kind of ableist fantasy of like of being normal, and kind of investing that term with more nuance and with a more accurate set of meanings based on disabled people's lives and lived experiences. For Jen and I, to crip the archive means to center disabled people in the histories that we tell, to acknowledge that disabled people are sources of knowledge, and to find creative methodologies to uncover their histories in archives that, by and large, erase, silence, obscure disabled people and their lived experiences in the histories that we study and the histories that we write.
Early on in the book, there's a quotation that gets shared. Disability is everywhere in history once you begin looking for it, but conspicuously absent in the histories we write. Jennifer, maybe could you tell me about the idea of disability and disability history and how you even begin to define the term?
Sure. That quote is from Douglas Baton, who is an amazing disability historian, along with many other amazing disability historians, that have really sort of challenged us to kind of rethink just how we understand disability and how, you know, disability is a lived experience and an identity, but we can also use it as a category of analysis, as a concept, as a way of sort of understanding like how ableism and ableist ideas about disability can be used against other groups of people, people of color, indigenous people, women, immigrants, like, you know, groups of people, who have been historically vulnerable. And I think, you know, that was a real kind of turning point in terms of disability history, was just that sort of expansion of disability from not just a lived experience, but also a sort of category of analysis, a way for historians to kind of think in broader terms about disability and to reckon with the kind of politics of disability historically, the ways that disability itself, you know, like I said, has been mobilized to support other kinds of discrimination, but also the way that it, you know, has erased people from the archives. And I think, you know, that quote really sort of, you know, a lot of folks, talk about that quote by Doug Baton because it's a really powerful quote. But I think for Stephanie and I, we wanted to dig into it even more and ask, like, well, why and how is this happening? happening, right? Because to us, we had to go back to the archives to sort of see like how this progressed and how we could engage in that.
Which brings us to, what did you find? What were some of the why and how this is happening? So I know it's a big collection with a number of different authors writing about different kinds of archives from different places on continents all over the world. But just give me a sense of what some of the themes were that emerged from all of that.
I think, well, maybe to start, I'll just share a little bit about mine and Jen's experience because we wanted to pursue this book because of our own kind of shared experience as historians of slavery. And we were really inspired by Black feminist scholars and scholars of slavery who have said kind of similar things about slavery's archive, that it obscures, that it, you know, enslaved people show up in the archive in these kind of fragments. So people like Marissa Fuentes and Saidiya Hartman, the late Haitian anthropologist Michelle Roth Trio, we are really inspired by these scholars' work on the archive. But we found that disability added this other layer of erasure to already incredibly marginalized people who kind of existed on the kind of fringes of the archive. But what we found was, you know, so going to the arc, going to slavery's archive, you're already, you know, kind of met with, especially in the Anglo-American world, you're already met with an archive that, as I said, is very fragmented when it comes to enslaved people's experiences. And then disability added this more, even further complexity. And when we were talking about this, it was like, wait a minute. So if we're finding these challenges when it comes to disability, surely other people are as well. But there was this tension between like this kind of silencing around disability, but also that it was very much there. It was both invisible and visible. So disabled people were showing up in the archives, but either no one was writing about them or they were showing up as these kind of nameless figures, either as just their diagnoses or, you know, their accident or whatever. So, one of the kind of exciting moments in the kind of nascent stages of this project was that we just put a call out and we just got flooded with all sorts of disability historians, disability studies scholars, community members who engage with this kind of silencing around disability. And they all had their own kind of take on where this showed up in their own line of work. And we were able to get authors from many different places in the world who study different places in the world, different kind of career stages, as well as in and outside of academia. So maybe I'll turn it over to Jen to kind of expand on that. But I just wanted to start with that kind of story because I think it really shows, yeah, just the origins of the book. And the one of the most pleasant things was that we weren't alone in our experience of the archive.
Yes, absolutely. When Stephanie and I had that initial conversation that kind of was the spark for the book, like we talked about things like, you know, both of our first books were based on the dissertations that we wrote finishing our PhDs. And, you know, there were people in our circles who were like, but what sources are you going to use? Like, how are you going to find? And we were like, you know, there are disabled people and, you know, the narratives of Mary Prince and Frederick Douglass and like all of these like really, really well-known, you know, enslaved people who wrote memoirs. And, you know, like, so we like they're there, like they're talking about disabled people. It's just that folks weren't seeing them. Like there was that phenomenon. But then, as Stephanie said, like also the sort of hyper visibility sometimes of disabled people, whenever they were sort of being interpreted and represented through an ableist lens, like as quote unquote freaks or right. Like there are just these ways that I think disabled people have shown up in incredibly ableist ways in the archive. So when we, you know, when we invited other folks to join the, you know, like we wanted to sort of see what other folks' experiences were. And as Stephanie said, it was really affirming to us on so many levels. But some of the same phenomena, like folks talked about that issue. Folks talked about like even the language of disability historically. I mean, it makes it very difficult to do archival research when disabled people have been described with these incredibly disparaging and ableist terms throughout history. How are archivists supposed to, document that, like in finding aids and things like that that we use to access these materials? And so it was really enlightening too, to have archivists join in the conversation, museum specialists, like other historians and scholars working in sort of disability studies writ large, folks who are thinking about community archives and the ways that disabled people themselves are building archives and what that looks like and what that means, which is incredibly powerful and important whenever we think about future histories that will be written. These will be the archives that folks will be drawing on someday. And I like to think that collectively we've made a little dent, right, in the kinds of like the shape of those archives and what they'll look like and whose voices will be represented.
In both the title and our conversation so far, the phrase the archive has come up a number of times. There are a number of different archives that get explored in the book. Stephanie, you were talking about the idea of the archive when it comes to slavery. There are other things, for example, an archive of an international organization that is meant to address the needs of deaf people. There is a lot of discussion about archives of, say, psychiatric institutions in the 19th century. Can you give me a sense of how some of the different archives maybe compare to each other? And like when we talk about the archive, what exactly are we talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question. Last year, I taught a course on the archive, a graduate course, and one of my non-history students famously said at the end of class, at the end of term, when I started this class, I had no idea what an archive was. And now I'm even more confused about what an archive is. And I was like, yay, we did it. But I think, one of the things that we wanted to do was to both look at archives that are like brick and mortar, the building that you go visit, but also expand that definition to think about, as Jen was referring to, community-based archives, digital archives, which are so good for accessibility reasons, not only disability, but finances and things that can prohibit people from actually going to the actual brick and mortar building. So we wanted to think more broadly about what an archive is. We have a chapter by an intergenerational deaf family who looks at like their own family archive. So thinking more broadly about that. But then, as you say, Joe, there are archives that kind of come with different power dynamics. So particularly institutional records that house people that were incarcerated in psychiatric institutions, they often come with a lot of restrictions. These are different based in, what country you're in. And I believe in the US, it's by state. In Canada, it's under the Canadian Archive Act, where names are redacted. And this could be, both a reflection of the kind of stigma around quote unquote madness or people who were deemed mentally ill. But also a kind of way to potentially safeguard any institutional repair, reparations, et cetera. So one of our authors, Sarah Hanley Cousins, talks about this in her chapter about the experience that she had trying to uncover the lives of people who were in these psychiatric institutions. And the difficulties in writing their life stories when so much of the information she had to change or alter or couldn't get access to. So these are some of the kind of challenges that historians and disability studies scholars face, depending on what archive they go to.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. My guests are Stephanie Hunt Kennedy and Jen Barkley. They've been exploring how disability is portrayed in the documents that become history. The pair are editors of a recently released book called Cripping the Archive. It's made up of 20 chapters looking at subjects that range from the work of deaf architect Adolf Loos to the psychiatric records of U.S. Civil War veterans. That was a really interesting theme that came up a few times that you just described there of it was really hard sometimes to access an archive, even for someone who had died a long time ago. And oftentimes the reason given was something like the protection of the privacy of maybe not even the person, but their family members, say, which, as you suggested there, maybe has the implication that there is some kind of stigma, and that whole idea is maybe even furthering that stigma that exists and contributing to it. And then, like, you peel back that layer, and it gets suggested that maybe even some of the reasons it's so hard to get some archives from some of these institutions is that they're worried about being sued. What do you think that whole situation has to teach us?
That's a really great question. I mean, I think it teaches us a lot of things. I think it teaches us, you know, like in this book, we think about, like I said earlier, the politics of disability in the past, but it also raises the question of the politics of disability in the present. You know, and what is that relationship between the past and the present? Like, what kinds of obligations do we have to the voices of people in the past, whether it's, you know, reclaiming them and making them visible and using them in our research? Or, you know, protecting them. I think it raises a lot of kind of ethical issues, but surely it also kind of puts on display, like, you know, the culpability, I think, of institutions in both of those ways, right? Like, why are they silencing things? And why is it such a challenge in some ways, like, to access these materials, which then, you know, as Stephanie mentioned, sort of begs the question, like, is this a protective act, a self-protective act, especially when there are so many other kinds of archival materials that don't face the same kind of conundrum, right? You know, as these kinds of sources and materials. Yeah. So, I think that's a really complicated question that has everything to do with power, which is in the title of the collection, right? Because that's something that we wanted to kind of expose and engage with and make clear just how that can shape these materials and these archives and these institutions.
On that other front of it reveals things about today, did you come across any maybe insights into if people are thinking about how they are contributing to tomorrow's archives and writing about things that are going on right now, what might be good to keep in mind with an eye towards disability history?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, broadly speaking, I think Jen and I, as I mentioned earlier, the work of Michel Roth-Trio is really inspiring to us. He writes about, you know, he argues that there's power in the production of history. And he identifies these four stages in which there's these huge power imbalances. And one of the first ones is just, you know, what gets recorded and then what gets archived, what gets retrieved, and then like how it's written about and how it's remembered. And I think for a really long time, disabled people, as well as other people marginalized by race and class and gender, sexuality, nationhood, et cetera, have been deemed kind of unworthy of being documented or unworthy of being archived. So being aware of those kind of power imbalances, I think is really important to recognize that, you know, that everyone's kind of lives and lived experiences are worthy of being archived and being written about. And we can't really, we shouldn't try to predict what might be, you know, deemed worthy in the future.
Yeah, no, I'll jump in too, because I think, you know, like many of the chapters that are part of the collection, like they even highlight to us, you know, like the group of scholars from Gallaudet University, you know, their chapter is fascinating because they're talking about the creation of deaf archives, but then, you know, they turn a critical lens to that, right? Like they crypt those archives as well. And they think about and talk about like the power dynamics that shape and even limit them, right? I think in the case of deaf archives, these scholars point out that they weren't all that these archives, aren't inclusive. Like they don't include the voices of all deaf people. They predominantly include the voices of deaf people historically who are elite, who are white, who are men, who are educated and could leave behind written documents. When that's not the sort of language that deaf folks would use, right? But until the advent of video technology, deaf archives really relied on written sources. So that meant who are the folks who are getting educated and who are the folks who are considered important enough, either locally or nationally, like to have their materials, archived and preserved. Women's voices, deaf women's voices were obscured, like there are all of these different layers. So I think in thinking about like archives going forward, like Stephanie mentioned intersectionality, and that's incredibly important to think about all these different, facets of disabled people's lives and who's getting brought into archives and who's being left out. And I think that many of these chapters highlight those kinds of dynamics and the importance of thinking intersectionally about people. I think too, like some of the other authors, like Grayson Brillmeyer's chapter is brilliant because it really sort of like challenges us to think about the impact of like ableist representations of disabled people in archives and how that can impact disabled researchers, like whenever they engage those materials. Like there is an affective or an emotional response to having to work with documents that either like reduce disabled people to their, quote unquote conditions, to their diagnoses, or that frame them in ways that kind of flatten their experiences, or misrepresent their experiences, having to think of like the so-called super crip or like the folks who overcome their disabilities. Like it's a really troubling kind of narrative to create about disabled people, and it's pervasive in the archives. So like that's something that we confront when we go into the archives. And that, has a particular impact on disabled researchers.
So far today, I feel like we've been taking a real bird's eye view look at the issues covered in the book. If we were to zoom in and go more granular, were there maybe any individual people's stories that emerged through this work that either of you really latched onto that have stuck with you?
I mean, it's hard. You're asking us to like pick our favorite child or something. That everything's so great, but I think there are a few that have kind of stuck with me. Nina Vollenbroecker's work on the archive of Adolph Loos. This is a story of a deaf architect, and she does this really incredible analysis of his architectural drawings and kind of how this reflects his sensory and visual world. There's another chapter by Leanna Cole that I really love, where she looks at psychiatric archives, but really uplifting the patients as theorists in their own right, people who would have been dismissed as like, oh, you're quote unquote mad. And kind of dismiss, she really uplifts them as these historical actors in their own right that are kind of contributing to an archive. And I think both of those kind of approaches really challenge traditional methods of archives and how we engage with sources.
Yeah, I think to mention a couple of other folks too, KJ Sarankowski writes about Jemima Wilkinson, who was this young Quaker girl from Rhode Island in the late 18th, early 19th century, who because of illness, she experienced a fever, a really bad fever, and the sort of the way that the narrative goes is that Jemima Wilkinson died, but in her body was born the public universal friend, this sort of genderless, nameless figure that developed a kind of cult following. They sort of relocated to Western New York, well, towards like Central New York, the Finger Lakes region, and like Sarankowski really sort of challenges us to think about the ways that disability and illness, are so prevalent in this narrative of the public universal friend. Yeah, they've really only been looked at as a sort of genderqueer individual and like sort of thinking about the ways that gender is or is not reflected in their like in their existence and but really to the detriment of like not thinking about disability and illness as such a central part of that narrative. So I think their chapter is really interesting in terms of zooming in on a specific individual. And then, of course, there are chapters where individuals just sort of emerge. Again, to mention Sarah Hanley Cousins' chapter, I think her chapter is really brilliant. She starts the entire chapter telling us about this man, this disabled Civil War veteran, and she gives us like all this. It tells us a story, and then she's like, "Except that's really not his name, like because I can't tell you his name because of the restrictions that exist around his right." So like you can see the power of what does it mean then to sort of try to tell narratives about individual people when you can't share all of the details of their lives and you can't really dig into the context of their lives, which is key to what historians do, right? Like that's we have to sort of dig into context if we're going to tell adequate and fully representational stories of people's lives. But whenever the archives say that you can't, right? When various laws says you can't, then it really sort of does impact the kind of work that we do. And I thought that was a really powerful way to kind of convey that by talking about the life of this individual man.
I found the chapter you mentioned about the public universal friend particularly striking, in large part because the author mentioned at the beginning that this was something that they had come across in the same way that I came across it, as in the kind of way where it's presented on some social media platform as, a short bit of written text over an image, maybe three little pictures on Instagram with no kind of sources, and bringing a particular angle to something. And I found it really emblematic of a lot of what I imagine professional historians are very conscious of these days, even more so.
No, that's a very powerful statement, and it's absolutely true. I always laugh and I tease my students all the time, and I say historians are really persnickety. Like we're and it's not like we're not trying to be difficult or contrary or whatever, but it is truly important to like trace things very carefully as they change over time, right? Sometimes year by year or decade by decade. So it's really problematic to be like, oh, this thing happened in 1700 and we can draw a direct parallel to today. It's like, but can you? And like, what are the nuances that you're sort of losing in the process? And then, sometimes folks are, like there are more nefarious reasons why people do that, right? Like there are political reasons, like there are, reasons why folks want to sort of distort or misrepresent the past, that have so much more to do with today, than it does, with that actual history. So it is important to dig in and to be persnickety and to focus on those details.
So that being said, maybe the answer to this is to be persnickety, to really focus in on the details, and rather than a specific thing, it's just like a mindset. But what do you think are the lessons that have emerged from all of this work that you and other authors have been doing, looking into how disability shows up or is conspicuously absent from the historical record?
I think one of the big things that we want the collection to do is to kind of call historians and interdisciplinary scholars to look at the archive anew. Historians are so familiar with the triad of gender, class, and race, but disability is often treated by historians as some kind of like abnormal human experience, that it's like exceptional, and therefore they don't do that kind of work. But disability is a universal human experience. We say in the book, like disability does not discriminate, right? Most of us will have experiences with disability if we're fortunate enough to live long enough lives. We really hope that scholars can recognize that disability is a really important analytic tool. It's a great way to teach students historical methodologies. We're talking about a huge portion of the population. Disabled people have always existed, even though the term is somewhat nebulous and can change over time and place. And so we really hope that, even if we're not converting historians to be disability historians, that they start to recognize that disability should be included in that familiar triad of gender, class, and race, and be recognized in the work that they do and the histories that they write.
Yeah, and I think to perhaps like say a bit more about that too, like, I mean, I agree with everything that Stephanie just said. She said so eloquently and so beautifully. But I think too, like our collection as a whole is about trying to ensure people reckon with the issue of representation, like the representation of people with disabilities, to look for them in the archives, to, you know, to critique the archives, to read through the kinds of materials and to read against the grain so that you can actually access aspects of their lives and their lived experiences, you know, to kind of capture the whole range of those experiences, you know, disabled people's agency and their joy and their heartache and their, you know, their struggles and like all of the messy things, right, that every human being like deals with, is the same for disabled people throughout history. And that can be reflected in the archives, or it can be present and just, you know, something that actually takes a little bit of work to like a bit of detective work to dig through and to find and to see. But you know, in the introduction, we sort of invoked a quote by William Lauren Katz, and we sort of paraphrased it. But the quote that we used was, "If you believe people have no history worth mentioning, it's easy to believe they have no humanity worth defending." So we really wanted to drive home that point that, you know, by reckoning with disability in the archives, it is an issue of representation, but it's also about, you know, it impacts people today. And it impacts the way that we all sort of see and think about the world around us.
This is People First Radio. Jen Barclay and Stephanie Hunt Kennedy are the editors of Cripping the Archive: Disability, History, and Power. It's a book that, through 20 different chapters, explores the way that disability shows up in the historical record, or oftentimes is ignored. In a sort of news you can use way, feels like a crass way to say it, but in a sort of news you can use way, were there any maybe problematic tropes or just big ideas you think it would be useful for everyone to have in mind? I'm thinking of things like, Jennifer, earlier you mentioned the idea of the super crip showing up in archives where disabled people are only mentioned in somehow like having this superhuman quality of overcoming their disability instead of just being viewed as people, or even just pretty straightforward ideas like it being a bit problematic if an organization meant to work on behalf of deaf people doesn't have a significant number of deaf people in its leadership. Are there any kind of like real tidbits that you think it's just helpful for everyone to know about the way we discuss disability or the way systems can better incorporate disabled people?
One of the more challenging perspectives in disability history and an adjacent field, math studies, is, you know, questioning these kind of medical diagnoses that have led to people being incarcerated. So, you know, I think a lot of people, scholars included, take for granted diagnoses of like madness or any kind of like psychiatric label. And they just kind of assume that those labels are real. You know, and that's why these people are in these institutions. But disability scholars and mad studies scholars challenge that the very notion that one can have a mental illness, and challenge the kind of that being grounds for incarceration. So I think that's probably, I mean, this is a probably you know, deserves a much longer conversation, but it is one of the things that I think is still really misunderstood when it comes to studying histories of people with psychological disabilities or who were institutionalized. And I think it has very present day implications because of the relationship between disability justice and abolitionist movements as well. Jen, do you want to expand on that?
I think that like that those narratives about kind of super crips and like folks overcoming their disabilities. Like, Stella Young did a brilliant TED talk on this called "I'm Not Your Inspiration." Thank you very much. And she talks about inspiration porn and the way that non-disabled people sometimes read these narratives in ways that simply make them feel better about themselves, but it's not really to kind of understand and access like whatever the topic is at hand from the perspective of the disabled person themselves, And I think like that can, those kinds of dynamics can be reproduced in archives. And, if we're not critical of them, if we're not thinking critically about how the archives are framing disabled people, then we could, uncritically reproduce those narratives in our work, whether it's historians are doing that or museum specialists who are curating exhibits or, like there's a whole slew of ways. And then once that's out there, right, then it becomes part of the quote unquote kind of public, sphere and the ways that we consume information. So I think we should be very mindful of those things, in addition to the dynamics that Stephanie was just talking about.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation today on this?
I think that, another thing that the book does, is as much as so many of our chapters, tell the histories of dispossession, of erasure, of silencing, of incarceration. They tell these stories while at the same time kind of challenging this deficit model of disability by highlighting not only the methodologies of uncovering histories or lives of disabled people from the archive, but also, as Jen said earlier, telling stories of joy and resistance and resilience and survival. And in many ways, the collection as a whole really reflects a lot of the values that are at the center of disabled communities and disability history, namely, community and reciprocity. We have a lot of collaborative chapters that were written collaboratively. I mean, Jen and I worked collaboratively. Also, this book was definitely written on Crip time. We started this collection in 2021, and it was published in 2025. So many different things happened in our authors' lives and in our lives. And I think it was just a real model of accessibility and of working in the kind of on Crip time, allowing people's lives to unfold without this kind of pressure to produce at a particular speed. And so that's something I'm really proud of about this collection.
Agreed. And I mean, it was just an honor to work with so many like amazing scholars and activists and thinkers and, folks who, it really sort of shaped and changed the way that I thought about my work too. I learned so much and, I'm so grateful that I had the opportunity to work with so many people. It truly was, a labor of love. I think sometimes big collections like this, there's a lot of logistics. It can be like time consuming or challenging, or sometimes I think folks can feel some frustration, but I don't think I ever felt that in this entire process. Like every step of the way was just like really exciting and really fun, from the initial like submissions of, people's abstracts and here's what I think I'm going to write about to, doing a meet and greet where we all got together online. And, it was fantastic. It was like, it just, I truly like from beginning to end, it's been a really amazing process and I'm really proud to be a part of it.
Ditto.
Well, Jennifer, Stephanie, thank you very much for taking some time to talk to me about it.
Thank you, Joe. Your questions were great. It was really awesome to be in conversation with you.
Yeah, thanks for inviting us. It was really a pleasure to be here.
Stephanie Hunt Kennedy and Jen Barclay are both history professors and editors of the book Cripping the Archive: Disability, History, and Power.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
Renata Roma says people are increasingly concerned about the emotional well-being of their pets. The University of Saskatchewan researcher says that it's important to keep in mind that the human-pet relationship isn't a magical one, and it's normal for it to have some challenges sometimes. I spoke with her about the interplay between the mental health of cats and dogs and their owners.
My name is Renata Roma. I have a PhD in child and youth studies, and my postdoctoral studies were working with interactions between people and animals, but this was also part of my PhD studies, so I would say I specialize in interactions between people and animals. At the same time, I am a psychotherapist qualifying, working with people with anxiety and also with people dealing with pet loss grief. So I am certified in supporting people dealing with pet loss grief.
You've shared that people are increasingly aware of the mental health of their dogs and cats. I'm wondering if you could tell me about that idea. Where are we getting that data from and what does it mean?
Yeah, this was a survey, so it's not a research-based data, but we have a lot of research that aligns with these findings. So with what this survey says is that people are more and more worried, not necessarily about their dog's physical health, but about their mental health. And at the top of this list is separation anxiety. So they are mentioning issues like when I leave my home, my dog has behavioral issues, and that it's difficult for them to manage these types of issues, which can be extremely stressful for guardians. So this is something that people are more aware of. And there are some possible reasons for this. So both for why people are looking at this, because maybe animals could be having some of these problems, but people could just ignore them. But they are paying attention to those issues. So I think that there are two aspects here: why animals are having more behavioral issues or mental health issues, and why people are paying attention to them.
There's this saying that's floated around out there the last couple of years, a saying along the lines of pets are the new kids and plants are the new pets. Is there maybe a research angle to that question? Is there anything that backs that idea up in the research?
Yeah, there are some studies showing that for younger generations, sometimes they prefer animals to kids. And so this is not just something that people say without being backed by research. And this seems to be something that is happening mostly among young generations, but we know that for older adults, this also sometimes happens. So yeah, I'd say that there is some truth to this statement.
And perhaps tied into that, you shared that there seems to be an increasing tendency to see pets as direct family members. What can you tell me about that idea?
Yeah, we have information that more than 90% of people, when we ask what your pet is for you, they describe them as family members. So this happens in different countries. So it's always around 90%, 95%. There is some variation when we compare different places in the world, but it's very high. So the emotional place of animals in people's lives is very different if we compare to how animals were perceived years ago. And we can even see this in the ways we name animals. It's more and more common that we use names of people or people that we like to name our pets. In the past, we used to look at physical characteristics of animals and choose their names. So we can see this in different aspects of our relationship with them. We also can see more pet-friendly places. There is an increasing tendency to bring animals to different social events and situations, and this wasn't something that we used to see in the past.
And that maybe brings us to this increasing awareness of pet mental health. You talked a little bit about the idea of separation anxiety being maybe one of the most well-known concerns. What do we know, broadly speaking, about the mental health of companion animals?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question because when we talk about mental health in animals, we are not talking necessarily about ever or innate behavior that is problematic because, like, anxiety is part of our lives and the same for animals. So, some level of anxiety is normal. The problem is when we have behaviors that show that animals are struggling to adjust to the environment, to their social life. So when we think about mental health in animals, we are talking about persistent issues that have an impact in their ability to manage situations in their relationships and in their environment, and that will have an impact in their welfare. And separation anxiety is something that might have increased. Also, after the pandemic, we see by research that after this period, people started describing more and more separation anxiety in their cats and dogs. And maybe like during the pandemic, we were home all the time. And although we think that this was always amazing for animals, they also have their safe space. So it's important for them to have time alone. When we started staying home all the time, we had more interactions with all our animals, but they lost this time alone. Another thing that happened with some people, with some dogs particularly, is that they used to go for walks every day, some or most of them. And then during the pandemic, most people stopped doing this. So opportunities for socialization with other animals decreased, which also could be a factor for more anxiety. And then we returned to our lives. And then some animals with tendency for separation anxiety, they might have struggled to adjust to this new separation that also wasn't something that was expected. So all these changes in a short period of time could have contributed to what we are seeing now.
You wrote in the conversation about this idea that, for example, if someone is being kind of anxious and fearful around an animal, then there's a good chance that the animal will pick up on that energy and maybe reflect it back. Can you tell me about that idea?
Yeah, I'm talking about this co-regulation in terms of emotions between people and animals. And we know by different studies, when we think about the level of stress, there is an association between someone's level of stress and their animals. When there is a very interesting study from 2024, where researchers asked people to simulate some emotions like sadness, happiness, and then they assessed the responses of dogs. When people showed sadness, for example, dogs were less active, they jumped much less. So we could see a kind of contagious in terms of emotions in people and animals. And many other studies show something very similar. Our mental health, we know also that there are more mental health issues in people lately, anxiety, depression. We don't have specific data on this, but I think this also might have a connection between this increase in mental health concerns that some guardians describe and their own mental health issues.
Yeah, you wrote about this idea that there's evidence that people's vulnerability to emotional stress may have increased in the last few years. Can you tell me more about that? How does that fit into the equation with pets?
Yeah, we usually pay attention to things that are important to us. So the stigma around mental health issue, and this is something great, is decreasing. So we are more comfortable to talk about mental health issues. We are more comfortable to talk to our friends, our partners. We see more campaigns talking about how important it is to discuss when something is not going well with you. So when we look at our animals, and if we consider that they are family members, it's not a surprise that we might be start wondering, what about my pet? My dog or my cat also has emotions, and maybe there's something wrong about them. So the interpretation that we have about different behaviors, so in this sense, there is a connection. We are concerned about something, so we started paying attention to things that are important for us. And yeah, I think this is the main connection.
This is People First Radio. My guest is Renata Roma. She's a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Saskatchewan, specializing in the interaction between people and animals. She recently wrote in The Conversation about people's concerns about the mental health of their pets. Now, when it comes to an increased awareness of the fact that, you know, our pets will have a state of mental health, whatever it is, whether it's, you know, perfectly healthy or whether they're having some kind of issue, how do we have that awareness without creating some kind of like anxiety spiral where we're so worried about it that we're somehow like making it worse?
Yeah, we should be concerned when a behavior starts being it starts creating a disruption in the relationship that we have with our pets, or when we see that they are not being able to cope with normal stressors in their lives. So anxiety is normal. Sometimes being fearful in social situations is absolutely normal, and we need to respect the dog's boundaries, so we don't want them necessarily to be comfortable in every single situation. So it's okay if the dog sometimes prefer not to be in some social situations, but the problem is when their quality of life decreases in consequence of such behaviors. So they might be losing opportunities to interact with other animals. Sometimes people start restricting who they will invite to come over because they have dogs or cats with behaviors that are really difficult to deal with. So when these behaviors start having an impact in the family dynamic, or some people might say, I will avoid some social situations because I prefer to stay home with my pet because he's unable to stay home for 2 hours, 3 hours. So something there needs to be carried. We need to pay attention to this. We expect that this bond between people and animals promote more mental health. So in the moment we see this is not happening, it could be that help is needed.
So there's this idea out there that companion animals are probably generally good for our mental health, but you've referred to a few examples there where maybe there are some challenges or there are some concerns that maybe people's behavior is being modified, maybe some things are even being enabled by the fact that they have animals that maybe are experiencing these issues. How do you try and navigate or mitigate some of those issues when they do come up?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it really depends on the issue. But first, acknowledging that the issue is there, then trying to find ways to manage this by yourself, trying to find help if it's needed. And acknowledging that this is a very complex relationship. Sometimes people expect that the relationship with animals will be perfect, will be magical, and then when they find some conflicts or some difficulties, they tend to think that they are doing something wrong, or maybe the dog is not a good dog, a good cat. So there's something different or wrong about them. And there are some behaviors that are very normal in animals. It's their way to express that maybe something is not going well and they need help. So trying to understand the meanings of some behaviors in animals can help us to identify and to mitigate some potential negative impacts that we will have in this relationship. But I would say it's important to normalize that this relationship is not perfect and it's okay if sometimes the dog is more stressed. We can provide more space for the dog that takes. It just happens with us, right? Sometimes we might have a partner that we love, but some days we don't want to be there. We need more space. So paying attention to the dogs or the cats' and needs can help us to respond to their needs in a way that will promote quality of life instead of creating issues for the animal and for ourselves.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation about this idea of pet mental health and an increased focus and attention on it?
No, maybe just this idea that we discussed before, that this is a very complex relationship, and the fact that it has some issues sometimes don't make it worse, just make it real. So if you are having any issues in understanding your dog or your cat, doesn't mean that something is wrong, but means that you are both real and like maybe you need help of from a professional, or maybe you need to pay more attention to your animal or to yourself. But yeah, it's not a magical relationship, but it's a very essential part of our lives. And yeah, but I think you made great questions, so that's all.
Well, Renata, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
No problem. Thank you.
Renata Roma is a researcher with the Positive Connections Lab at the University of Saskatchewan. She specializes in interactions between people and animals. That is it for the show this week. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.